Hello and welcome to another episode of Chai with the Pre-Med Guys, where my friend Wally Prezada and myself, Syed Khan, share with you the stories of experienced medical students and medical professionals. Our hope is that through these stories, you might be able to find the answers to questions or challenges you have been facing in your pursuit to medicine. We have a special guest today joining from Stony Brook Medicine, Dr. Josh Magoo. Josh completed a BS in biochem and BA in chemistry at the University of Rochester, his hometown. He then went to complete an MS in biomedical science at Mount Sinai. Josh then went on to medical school at Stony Brook University, where now he is an emergency medicine resident. I actually first got to know Josh through your Twitter account, where you put out a lot of your medicine-related topics, especially your mnemonics. I haven't gotten into med school, but I was like, wow, the mnemonics are kind of catchy. This is really nice. And your posts on LinkedIn, they're also very informative as well. So that being said, it's so great to have you here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? And how you're doing these days?
The dreaded tell me about yourself questions in med school interviews. It follows me forever, man. But happy to be here. My name's Josh. I'm an emergency medicine resident at Stony Brook, but I'm a dad. I have a toddler at home, originally from upstate, trying to figure out the residency thing without any family members in medicine and things like that. So just happy to be part of the journey and happy to share whatever anyone finds useful on this podcast, my guys.
Josh, thank you so much for coming on. It's an absolute pleasure to have someone from Stony Brook on the podcast. You know, Syed and I always feel like, okay, there's someone we can relate to about all our struggles and all the great memories we had at Stony Brook, you know, good and bad, all of it. And speaking of, you know, dreaded med school interview questions, we have perhaps the most dreaded one, which, you know, it's probably been a while since you've heard this one, but we'd like to take you all the way back and ask you why you decided to go into medicine.
Yeah, you know, there was always a patient-centered care focus in my household. My dad's a social worker. He mostly does substance abuse counseling. My mom was a home health aide for folks with disabilities. She would work overnight with adults with autism or Down syndrome or certain other intellectual disabilities. So there was always some kind of like a me talking to sick people or a conversation surrounding patients. But I don't really have any doctors, nurses, PAs, NPs in my family. I originally was in high school. I was good at science. And like every other 16-year-old or whatever, I would think, oh, if you're good at science, you can either be a doctor or an engineer. And I didn't have any of the doctors. So I just figured engineering was my thing. Fast forward until like the second week of one of my engineering classes, I realized I don't like engineering. I'm not good at math. And this was all terrible. So I kind of was in a lost space for a couple years of college. I did the like Western blots and PCRs and killed a bunch of mice in college trying to figure out the science thing. But the part that was missing for me was the talking to people component. That's the part even still about medicine that I like the most. And I kind of fell into becoming a scribe for Scribe America. And I followed around all these doctors and they got to see sick people and that was their job. And I kind of caught the pre-med bug later in college, my junior, senior year, mostly because I didn't see myself doing anything other than that. And I guess the rest is history.
That's awesome. That's awesome. No, it's great. You know, like when I, it's always interesting to see the contrast of like, cause we just had a surgeon on recently and you know, they're like, their remark was, oh, you know, I actually more so than interacting with patients, I like the surgery itself or like I like the research itself. And, you know, at the stage, it's so interesting to hear at the stage we're at where, you know, a lot of people are discovering, oh, you know, like I like science, but also people, you know, it's kind of like the I'm a geese goose meme right. Going on. And, you know, the same as you, like Syed and I, you know, it may have been killing worms for us, but, you know, the combination of like killing worms/rats and then realizing you're a people person. It's always interesting to hear how different, but then also how similar everyone's stories of why medicine are.
Yeah. They always converge at some point, you know, and there are certain people skills involved with working in a lab or working in other settings. I have some friends that do like pharma consulting now or work at McKinsey, and there's definitely a people component to it. But selfishly for me, I didn't want to do research that would eventually impact people. I wanted to be the guy who impacted a person there. on a one-to-one basis. So it all, I've learned as I've gone through the process, it all involves some level of people skills. It's just the people skills I wanted just to be with sick people. I didn't really want much beyond that.
No, yeah, like it's also really funny that while you mention it, it's like it's always like killing some sort of organism and like just and just talking to like, you know, just sick patients or just patients in general. Like everybody has like somewhat of a similar story. It's like, yeah, I killed a bunch of worm. I like talking to people, so medicine it is. But just wanted to
that was
go
us,
back
yeah.
Yeah, just wanted to go back into for your undergrad experience. You know, like whenever like undergrad 4 years, you're bound to have some sort of failure, some sort of like struggle, or whether it be like with your GPA or MCAT or like experience. So I was just wondering, like, did you have any struggles that you struggled with and during your time in college, and how did you sort of get over it?
Yeah, we can talk about grades. I got a C in Gen Bio. So that's not a strong place to start with if you're ever thinking about pre-med. I remember I met with a pre-med advisor my junior, senior year because I just caught the bug, right? And she was like, well, got a C in bio, and med school is a lot of bio. So, like, they told me not to even bother. So that was challenging, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you have all of this, like, some of it's naive, but all of this eager, like, I'm going to help people. Like, let's stay in college and education until I'm 30. Like, let's do this thing, you know? And then you kind of get the people who put you down on the process. So that was challenging. I think like a lot of other people, I said to a lot of things because I felt like there was an expectation of me more than what I was actually intrinsically motivated to join in college. If I could do it again, I probably would have done like chemistry and a music degree rather than like biochem and chem, because I felt like the double degree would matter in the grand scheme of things. I did a bunch of things because I felt like other people wanted me to do it rather than what I was actually into. So that's one of the things when I talk to pre-meds now, I say that the number one goal should be as happy as possible, as long as you can throughout the process, because it's too long of an education to kind of burn out your sophomore year because you're taking a bunch of classes that you think med schools would care about. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. I think personally for me, it's like the first 2 years I really cared about, or first 2 years in Stony Brook, I really cared about like checking boxes. I think a lot of pre-meds just like struggle with that part where it's like, I have to do research now, then I have to do clinical experience, then I have to take this class and this class. I always have to be a bio major because, you know, you really have to like fit yourself in that mold. So I feel like everybody really has that sort of experience that they need to like sort of break out of, like break out of the box, saying like, okay, I can be a linguistics major and still go into medicine. It maybe it doesn't apply, maybe it does apply, who cares? I'm happy at the end of the day.
Yeah, for sure. Happiness is the number one goal. And I wish I learned that 8 years ago, but never too late, I guess.
Never too late.
Right. And Josh, I just wanted to ask you more about, so was that sort of the lead up to your pursuing a master's before med school, of, you know, sort of that uncertainty, or, you know, did you want to like beef up your GPA, or walk us through the thought process of, you know, choosing which masters, you know, even deciding that you wanted to do a master's, and in hindsight, just what you think you gained from that?
Yeah, so it was a couple different components. The first one was definitely to bolster my academic credentials, because since I didn't become pre-med until later in college, I didn't have all those straight A's and all my prereqs, because I originally thought, oh, I'll do some kind of engineering or something else, and I'll get a co-op or some kind of internship. Like, it doesn't matter if I have 4.0. So part of it was building up those credentials to kind of show to medical schools that I had the rigor involved. The second part was, I got engaged my senior year of college, and my wife and I wanted to move down to New York City. And I don't know if you know a lot about New York City medical schools, but they just happen to be like some of the most competitive places in the entire country. So that was another reason why I felt like I really needed to get my grades up. And the third reason was to, for me, take some extra time to mature. I feel like not everyone needs to do a standard 2-gap year process, but I feel like I really wanted to learn, as a newly married person, as someone who didn't have family in the space, just to kind of allow myself to mature for those 2 years, really meet a ton of doctors. Like, what does a rheumatologist know? I have no idea. Let's go find a couple. What is surgery actually like? What kind of surgeries are there? Is there orthopedic? What's the difference between that and procedural specialties like anesthesia or emergency medicine? What are the tropes that go into the different specialties? I really wanted to take those 2 years to mature as a husband and a person, but also as an academic. So that was my main criteria. As for figuring out what kind of master's to apply to, I was very direct with multiple programs. I would reach out to them and say, like, what's your track record? What's the average GPA? Who applies to medical school? How many of them get in? And if they didn't give me some clear data or statistics, that was a big red flag for me, and I didn't even bother. But if certain people had, like, oh, we have MCAT courses, we can help you with interview prep and different resources. And it was also a research program. That was what Mount Sinai told me, and they had a really strong track record. So those were the considerations I had, because it's expensive, right? Like, I'm bankrolling this entire process with loans, and if you're going to drop 70, 80 grand, I wanted to make sure it was a worthwhile investment.
No, absolutely. I think that's like a big part that now people are sort of figuring out a little bit. Because it's like gap years are becoming more and more popular. Like me and Wally, we're both in our gap years right now. So it's like a lot of people do choose like the master's route. We chose like the working route. We wanted to get more like working experience to see how research in medicine actually is like, if this is a field we like. But a lot of people just directly like hop from one schooling to another. And like the points you just raised is very, very interesting that like, okay, you need to know all these things, if they can support you or not. And if they don't, then you need to choose another sort of avenue or another school. One more thing I wanted to really ask you about, like you, before our conversation, you were talking about how you were a consultant at Blueprint and like you had spent a little bit of time at pre-med tutors. Given that your background, you had a little bit of, not a straight path, I would say, going into medicine, is that what some inspired you to like also mentor pre-med students, help them through this process, and how has it been so far?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's been an interesting process. There are parts of it I don't like, if I'm honest, because it's terribly expensive. And like Blueprint and a lot of these companies itself is something that I didn't use. I couldn't afford it. The reason why I wound up with Blueprint was one of their, if you guys know about like Dr. Gray, he has a bunch of podcasts and med media, and he has like 45 podcasts now. Mm-hmm. But I learned everything I learned to get into medical school, from classes, interview prep, everything through free resources, through podcasts, through YouTube videos. And my role more at Blueprint now is with some of their social media things and some of their free resources, rather than having students who paid for the resource to work with me. And that was just something I was more comfortable with, because I feel like there are so many prohibitive things in this process. And I felt like so much of it was behind a paywall. I'm super happy to have a role there where now I do things that are virtually exclusively free. The students that I work with now were kind of legacied in by people they work with in previous cycles, but were unsuccessful. So I like working with the students who aren't paying to see me. They're kind of working with me because they had a lack of success with other people. So I'm happy that my role there is kind of in alignment with what my situation was like as someone who couldn't afford it.
Wow, that's awesome. That's awesome to hear that. It's absolutely, you know, even Saeed and I, you know, as we prepare for like the process, it's so, like you said, there's so many financial roadblocks. You know, you'd have to. My first thought was saying the MSAR, but that's not really that expensive. But you know, you have to pay for the critical analysis test. I forget what it's called, the interview. You have to CASPER preview. You have to pay for that. You have to pay for primaries, secondaries, all that jazz. And you know, it really is such an interesting process to think about. And you know, clearly you've been through that as well. You know, you talk about with having to take out loans for your master's programs as well. And I wanted to ask, you know, as an advisor, what's the largest pitfall you see most pre-meds fall into that maybe is a curve or a trend that, you know, could have the greatest area of improvement, whether that's something that, you know, pre-meds should know applying, or whether that's something they should know 4 years before applying?
Yeah, I'll answer this in two ways. one, I kind of mentioned before, doing anything for anyone else other than you in this whole process, I think is a big mistake. Like this whole mentality of, oh, it's just going to suck this year, but next year is going to be great. And if I'm just as a senior, if I work really hard, first year med school is going to be a cakewalk, which, spoiler, it's not. Doing anything for anyone else because you think, oh, it'll get me an edge, is just going to lead to burnout. And I think the sooner people realize that if you're as happy as possible and you're like glowing your senior year on your med school interviews or whatever, because you prioritize yourself, that really comes through in a meaningful way. As someone who does interviews now. And the second thing is to really know where you're getting advice from. A lot of the advice from Reddit or certain three-letter websites on the internet, Student Doctor Network, or like Twitter or different resources, a lot of it is an echo chamber of other pre-meds who think they know what they're talking about, talking to other pre-meds, or like one guy with a 495 and a 2.3 GPA that got into Harvard, thinking they know what they're talking about, talking to a guy with a 527 and a 4.0 that didn't get in anywhere. Like, it's generally not that helpful. So people taking real stock on who they're taking advice from and what their credentials are, knowing that even if their credentials are good, most of it probably wouldn't apply to you, right? Like, I'm like a straight white middle-class guy from upstate New York. Like, my story is not going to align with so many other people, you know? So those are definitely the two first things that come to mind.
That's great to hear, because, you know, the second point you made, that's actually why, you know, Said and I started this, because, you know, we recognized that, you know, it wasn't even early on. We recognized when I was in my senior year that, you know, we don't know. Like, there's so much about this process. We just don't, we're clueless, you know? Mm-hmm. And anytime we went on the internet, that would be another problem. Like, there's so many opinions that you can tell at the same time that, you know, all these people definitely don't know what they're talking about. But then at the on the other hand, you're like, well, how do we differentiate that? So, you know, and we thought maybe this platform would, you know, for anyone that cares to listen to our 1 hour long sessions of, you know, getting educated by people that do know what they're talking about, we thought that would help. But what really I found interesting was the first thing you said of, you know, as someone that now is on the other end of the whole process, you recognize when someone's really done things for themselves or when someone's glowing in an interview. And I don't know, I feel like I know so many pre-meds that are doing not that, whereas if you're, according to what you're saying, that's what they should be doing. You know, so many people, perhaps it's a mindset, a problem of mindset where, you know, someone's going through a rough pre-med journey and the mindset they adopt to sort of make it through is that, okay, you know what, it's rough right now, but I just need to weather through this storm and accept that it is a storm, and, you know, I'll be beaten and bruised by the end. But when I get to that interview, I'll tell them about how, oh, I went through that storm and that shows my commitment. But right now we have you telling us that, you know, working on yourself, you know, working towards the end point, that when you get to that interview, you're not all battered and bruised and mentally worn down, but instead, you know, you're glowing because, you know, you've figured out what you want and you're optimistic about it. That's a very interesting point of view to hear. And I mean, that's why I'm glad that we're having you on the podcast for that reason. And I'd love to hear your personal experience of, you know, going through applications and how you chose Stony Brook as a school.
Yeah, you know, I applied to 30 MD and DO schools, which you can do the math, was expensive. There were credit cards involved and took a long time to pay them off. My wife and I walked a lot of dogs together in New York City, and we babysat a lot of kids to pay for that. Like I said before, our priority was New York City. Or the area with proximity to the city. So that limited us somewhat. Outside of New York City, we applied to other major urban areas. My wife does like Fashion Week stuff and dance, and she was in a Latin dance company for a while. So the places for her where she was going to find work would be in large cities, probably not in the middle of a cornfield in Iowa, nothing against Iowa. So that limited it somewhat. The reason why I wound up at Stony Brook was state tuition saves probably 20 grand a year, which is significant. after I got into Stony Brook, I learned that they had a 3-year MD program, which knocked off a year of training as long as you stayed there for residency, which when I explained to my wife, who also had no one in medicine, how, you know, during fourth year, there's this process where you spend the entire year interviewing, and then there's a magical algorithm that spits out, which is tomorrow, March 13th for people, you matched or not, which is a life-changing, altering notification. And then that Friday, you learn where you're going to go. And if you don't like that, you can either go to that spot or just not practice medicine and maybe try again next year with a scarlet letter on your entire application. So that's terrifying. So when I learned about this program and I would have a guaranteed spot in emergency medicine or whatever specialty other people choose, that was kind of an easy decision for us just for the security, in addition to the obvious financial benefits of having training finish early.
No, that's actually very nice to hear that that Stony Brook has this sort of option for medical students that are already interested in emergency medicine, or somebody who's looking off, looking to basically settle down, put their roots in. Because if you really think about it, it's like me and Wally, but we both have almost a mentality where it's we'll go wherever it takes, wherever a school takes us, essentially. So there's a lot of moving involved. I just really wanted to ask you, I am in this personal dilemma about a specialty to choose, right? It's I really can't see myself doing XYZ, or I don't really have knowledge about it. I just wanted to know, how did you get to choose emergency medicine? Did you have any doubts beforehand? Because a lot of people do change their mind when they go into medical school with a preconceived notion that I'll be a surgeon, I'll be, I don't know, internal medicine doctor or something like that. And they do a 180 or something like that.
Yeah, and it's true, right? 90% of the people who wanted to go into orthopedics at first year changed by fourth year. And I'll answer it with perhaps a non-traditional answer. For my interview for the 3-year program, you interview with the residency leadership. So the 4 program directors for the residency, and they all asked me that question. And I didn't say, I came out of the womb with Diet Coke addiction and wanting and ADHD, you know what I mean? I didn't come out that way. And I told them that if I change my mind, I'll let you know, and I'm going to drop out of the program, which is not usually what you say at interviews, right? It's oh, this is my number one choice. I'll ride and die for this or whatever. And I said, hey, right now, of the things that I've seen so far, is emergency medicine by a mile. The OR makes me nervous. I never know what to do with my hands. Everything is sterile. I don't really like anything outpatient. I want to be in the hospital, and I want fast. And emergency medicine sounds like that. And I told the program leadership, if I wake up in the middle of third year and I'm like, I was wrong, it's urology or whatever, that I would let them know. Because the only difference would be now I have to do a fourth year of medical school and apply for the match, which is a small price to pay compared to a 30-year career in a specialty I don't like. Right. And that's what I told them. And I said, I would much rather take the L in the short term and actually enjoy my career than to try to save some money up front. And I think it was kind of a gamble telling them that, but I guess it resonated with them because I got me in the program. So that was kind of my philosophy with it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And I guess that's also something says something about the people that were interviewing you, that, they admired that transparency. Right. But I'd love to know, going forward from there, since you are essentially in the 3-year program, it's somewhat different schedule wise from your 4-year counterparts. Syed and I were talking before the episode, and Syed brought up this point actually where, your med school experience, we were wondering how it was different, or rather, rather than the straightforward answer of just, it being 3 years rather than 4 years, how is your mindset different? Because correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of med students, they're probably trying to chase that goal of, okay, we have to get into this residency, or you mentioned orthopedics, so I need to get into ortho, research year, all that. They're chasing that clear vision, whereas you're sort of you've already gotten the residency. So I was just wondering how you think that set aside your med school experience as opposed to your counterparts.
I mean, med school is hard regardless, but I was chilling, man. All I had to do was pass, which is hard, right? To pass certain parts of medical school. like preclinical neurology was really hard for me because I found it quite dry. But I just had to pass. I didn't have to do some volunteer committee of whatever just because I felt like I had to. Like, if I wanted to do a research thing because I thought it was fun, then I did that. We had our daughter my first week of my pediatrics rotation, so that was fun. So like, I just kind of did all the things that I wanted to do. I stayed healthy. I exercised a lot. I read books that weren't in medicine. And I felt like I ended up having better grades as a result of that because I wasn't constantly trying to get like honors on everything and pump out publications that no one's going to read. Like, I never had to do that. So I think it had this funny way of making my grades better as a result. But one of the themes of my like short career thus far was like, I didn't put anything on hold for medicine. Like, we wanted to have kids and then we had one, and we wanted to still see our family whenever we could and go back home. And we still wanted to go see like the SpongeBob musical in New York when it came out. Like, we did whatever we wanted to do. And I feel like that was really refreshing. The only challenging part about the 3-year program is like, if you fail anything, you're kind of, it's very easy to get out of the 3-year program. So there were some times where it was like, I was kind of close on that passing edge, and you kind of had to reel it back in and be more of a student. But overall, it was a big weight that I just never had on my shoulders that a lot of my peers did.
No, that sounds like a great time, because like every single time, like at Albany Med, I see medical students. It's like, they're just hanging on for dear life. Sometimes I talk to them, they're like, oh, what are you doing? It's like, going home, studying. And I'm like, what are you doing after that? Probably sleeping. Like, that's about it. So it's like, they're putting a lot of their life on pause for that. Just to talk more about like medical education per se, you use your Twitter account to push out a lot of mnemonics that like it just sticks, and I see a lot of like retweets, a lot of likes. So it's like, it's definitely a lot like very popular. So I just wanted to ask you about some advice to like our pre-med students who just got into medical school. Like, how would you recommend them taking on the medical school curriculum? You said it was very difficult. We all know it's almost like drinking from a fire hydrant. How would you go about giving advice to studying?
You know, studying in medical school, I start from the background of figure out what works with you. And if it does, don't listen to anyone else. Like, I would figure out pretty early if Anki works for you or not. And if it does, roll with it the entire time. And if it doesn't, that's okay. Like, sometimes people would try to like brute force Anki working for them for 4 years and it sucks. Don't recommend it. Other than that, you can find the 3 or 4 resources that work for you. Boards and Beyond, UWorld, AMBOSS, Sketchy, First Aid, whatever. Like, find the 2 or 3 resources that you like the most and just do that. Oftentimes in medical school, there are 75 different YouTube videos, podcasts, resources that you can listen to. And it doesn't benefit you to learn the Krebs cycle again from 7 different people. Just learn it once from the person who you like the most and then just move on from there. You don't need to brute force all these different resources. That's my first thing. And the second thing I'll say is medical school is very challenging from a time standpoint, but at the level that you learn in as a medical student, it's not that complicated. And I know I might sound like a jerk when I say that. My reasoning is I have friends who did PhDs and they learn an incredible depth of knowledge over a single thing. Medical school is more like during first year, you learn a large breadth of knowledge superficially, and then it becomes gradually more deeper as you go. So a lot of medical school is just cast as wide of a net and just learn as many things as possible, knowing that it'll take an entire career to gather that depth. Because sometimes you'll think like, I don't know, what's something stupid? Like a lysosomal storage disease that like only certain populations get. All you need to know is what's the enzyme, what's wrong, what does the question look like, move on. You don't need to know the entire PhD's worth of knowledge of why this works. Just get enough to get the question right and move on, because medical school is too wide of a net to do much more than that without really stressing you out, man. Like, that'd be too much.
Right. And what you just sort of said reminds me of a conversation we had with one of our other guests, actually, where he said verbatim, it kind of resembles what you just said. He said verbatim, med school is not hard, it's just a lot. And you know, he elaborated over a minute where, you know, the content is not complicated, it's just there's so much of it, and it really is, you know, just water out of a fire hydrant. Like, water is not complicated to see, it's just a lot of it out of a fire hydrant.
Yeah.
And Saeed and I, actually, this was when we were dawning upon, you know, we were like, why don't we start putting clips of the podcast on TikTok? And, you know, none of the videos were like getting much traction, but we were like, okay, yeah, we're just doing this anyway. But that specific video where the first 1 second opening of the video is, med school is not hard, it's just a lot. So many comments.
Oh, the comments were crazy.
Oh my god, how could you say that? Yeah. Like, oh my god, this, that, the other. I have to do like 1,000 Anki decks. And I wanted to ask you, you know, as someone who has this unique position as someone with a social media following, or even someone that's you know, you're trying to make an impact, at least to some degree, on like med ed, whether that's at the pre-med level or, you know, with even sharing your mnemonics, which I'm sure help a lot of people. I wanted to ask why you think, or whether you think there is a sort of culture of forcing down people's throats those same, you know, Anki and like traditional studying tools, where, you know, I think it creates a perception, not even just for med students, but even for pre-meds, where, you know, if they see all this content of, you know, med students doing Anki, eating and sleeping, that's it. And, you know, those doubts start creeping up when they have hard times as pre-meds, where, you know, wow, I'm having a hard time with Gen Chem. How am I going to become an Anki god, you know? So,
like, what would I tell a pre-med or someone in that situation?
Yeah, or what do you think that there exists that sort of culture of, you know, harsh lashback against, or just a culture that creates reluctancy to, you know, using stuff other than Anki?
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. There's definitely a culture behind that. Mm-hmm. Whether or not your medical school accepts it or not is a different thing. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, at Stony Brook, they know that lectures are recorded. Maybe six of the 130 of us would go, because oftentimes our time is better suited. If we do watch lecture, it's at 2.5 speed on the treadmill at home, because otherwise I'm not going to get any steps in. They also recognize that these people who develop these resources are incredibly smart, and they built their entire platforms, UWorld, First Aid Boards and Beyond, Anki, for the metric that is the single most beneficial thing in medical school. They're built for your board exams. And those are the couple grades that will make and break your entire career. And I think schools are starting to recognize that. And I think the sooner schools realize that the old, like, textbook sitting down for a lecture to learn content is dead, and we can move on to more efficient uses of time, like more case-based learning, or, hey, you just watched in this UWorld video these things, here's a case of a patient who will come with that. And that's what real life is for. That's what medicine is for, right? And I think the sooner we transition to that, the better. And I think the sooner we recognize to students, the same way why lectures don't work for anyone, and that's okay, not everyone, not anyone, Freudian slip. Similarly, why if Anki doesn't work for everyone, that's okay too. I think that just makes a more inclusive learning environment, and that's good for everybody. So I think instead of this insider, outsider, what's wrong with me that Anki doesn't work, instead of saying, oh, I'm more of an audio learner and I listen to podcasts, and I get to walk my dog and I can be healthy at the same time and learn the material, I think the better. It's going to result in more inclusion in medical schools, more different types of minds and mindsets. And I think that's good for patients and for learners.
Right. That's awesome. That's awesome. And it probably creates like more sane doctors, you know, who haven't been through all that nonsense. And I wanted to ask you, you know, I'm glad you brought up Stony Brook and how their specific culture is with regards to the learning, and I wanted to maybe expand that a little bit more about, like, what, now that you're a resident, you know, what it is looking back that you value about your specific experience at Stony Brook, or, you know, meeting other residents from other med schools, what you think set aside your med student experience at Stony Brook from that may not be available at other med schools.
Yeah, and I definitely encourage anyone applying to medical school to think about these things. The first one was no required lectures other than the like how to be a doctor classes where you think about histories and physicals and things like that, lectures for content were not required, which was huge. Since my first year was early COVID in March 2020, they changed all the preclinical courses to strictly pass-fail because honors high pass-pass-fail is just A, B, C, and F. It's just with a different coat of paint. So we changed that to strictly pass-fail. So if you got a 70% or an 100%, it all resulted in pass. So you could focus on the other things that kept you sane during those early COVID times. And then they just kept it because everyone loved it. So that's another thing about Stony Brook that I liked. Another thing is a lot of the faculty leadership, like the deans, are physicians that are still practicing. A lot of them are emergency physicians, which I love as an EM resident. But I think it adds a different perspective if your leadership in an institution that's teaching you how to care for patients is still caring for patients themselves. Like there isn't like an out of touch, like what's the health record system or what do you mean we don't have paper charts anymore? Like it's good for people to still have that perspective of seeing sick people because it keeps them kind of boots on the ground. They can check in with students because they rotate, like what's the vibe of the school right now? And no school is perfect. But having those people that are receptive to feedback is certainly helpful. One of the things my first year that they changed for future years was we had maybe three slides on like LGBTQ and like trans health, like three slides. Like I think it was like 6 minutes in one lecture, one time at the end of first year. And we were like, that's not enough. How many people, like, how am I going to interact with these people? And we have like a standardized patient with a trans patient. What's kind of inclusive language that otherwise could be offensive, but well-intentioned? How can you build rapport with patients who are so different from like a cisgendered person, what you're used to? And I think that was really useful as a resident where now like I can walk into a room and be like, hey, what pronouns do you use? What do you want me to call you? And how you can build rapport with patients who are already underserved and neglected by the medical profession in general. So I think things like that have really built dividends from Stony Brook now that I'm a resident.
No, that's great. I think those are very important parts about Stony Brook. I think like previous guests we had, like they really loved that part. I think like they were saying, it's like, oh, like during like they have like winter courses, summer courses where they really have this sort of how to talk or how to be in like an underserved area and like not essentially like offend them while you're trying to take care of them, whether if it's like intentional or not intentional. One of the things, what's it called? Did you wanted to add anything?
Nah, you're good. Sorry.
No, that's good. So it's like, you were just talking about like big decisions that happened over like COVID and whatnot. One of the big decisions that is like, you know, headlines, news, like in med ed is like making step one pass fail. A lot of people have a lot of different opinions about like, oh, it's a good thing that like step one is pass fail now. A lot of other cohorts of people are saying like, okay, good, it's pass fail, but it's going to have like rippling effects onto like other parts of the exams that are still there. And you know, like what is your opinion like on that part? Like, did you appreciate that part? Or like, do you see anything that's like, that might be changing in like residency? Do you see any new residents coming in saying like, oh, maybe step one is pass fail, made it harder, made it easier? What do you think?
Did you guys know step one was pass fail when it started?
I did not.
No, actually, no.
It was originally pass fail at a time before there was standardized curricula for medical students. And the pass rate was remarkably low because the curriculum was not standard. It was a more recent development where they gave it a grade because they had so many applicants for so many competitive positions and they needed some way to delineate between those people. So it was pass fail. And then it wasn't for seemingly good reason to kind of risk stratify. Is this person cut out for dermatology or not or whatever? The one negative, if there is one that I can't relate to, because emergency medicine, anesthesia, medicine, all these like not super competitive specialties doesn't really affect me a ton. So for the people applying for plastics, derm, ortho, interventional radiology, whatever, my heart really goes out to them because that and step two were like two of the biggest ways they could delineate themselves from other people. So not having that must be really challenging for them. I think in the long term, we'll realize that it was better for their mental health. And I think a lot of the bad press around, well, now we only have step two, hopefully goes away, and it turns into, what work have you done in the field? What relationships have you formed with people in the field? And then it just becomes how to get a job. Like, people in the real world don't come and say, like, man, I really crushed my accounting exam, and then they work at McKinsey. That's not how it works. They meet the right people, they develop relationships, and they say, wow, I really want to work with this person. And for people going into 3 to 7 for neurosurgery, 45 years of post-medical school training, I hope it becomes more, hey, I don't care much about your score. You passed our basic credential for knowledge, and now I care about who you are as a person. I feel like this is the first step as we gradually get towards that, knowing that it's going to be muddy for the next several years as programs figure out what to do in the absence of step one.
No, yeah, absolutely. It's something to, like, really think about, essentially. It's just, you know, what are other criteria? Like, some applicants are not taking research years in order to, like, de-alienate themselves from, like, the regular crowd, or essentially. I feel like it's pushing a lot of, like, medical students to really think, of course, A, like, make connections in the field, which is really important. But another rippling effect that people are saying is, like, now you have to take a little bit more time to really, like, make sure you show them that you're committed in this field that you want to be in.
Yeah, you know, I have a lot of friends for, like, ENT and opto, and, like, it's almost standard now that people take a research year, which, because I don't want to sound like a hypocrite, I like that people are getting the relationships and the experience based on what I just said. But the problem I have with research years is research years and unpaid or lowly paid positions are generally amenable to people who already have the financial resources that allow them to do that, right? Like, if both your parents are dermatologists and you want to take an extra year at their practice, and they can either pay you or not, and you can live with them because they're multimillionaires, like, sure, I'm sure that's fine for you. If I wanted to go into a field like that, I would really have pause on taking a research year because I have 350 grand in debt. We can't afford childcare right now because it's too expensive. And I have a kid to feed too. Like, I can't just bootstrap rice and beans for a year because I have a family to think about. You know what I mean? So I'm glad people are taking time to dedicate towards those fields, but I worry about if they're self-selecting the people can afford it before they even start.
Of course. And of course, there's, like, that inherent, like, bias that's already, like, built into, like, the medical system to, like, begin with, that, you know, people that go into medical school, they're privileged to begin with. Like, you know, it's a privilege to, like, have all this money to apply to begin with. So no, that's a really interesting point that you made up, and it's something to, like, really think about. I just want to, like, segue a little bit onto how it was for you in order going from, like, medical school to residency. One of the points I want to bring up is Dr. Glockenflecken, I think that I'm pronouncing that right. His videos about how an EM resident should be. And I see, like, he has this, like, bike suit as well as, like, the bike helmet as well as, like, Diet Coke you mentioned. I was like, is that how it really is in emergency medicine? Is the stereotype, like, do some of the stereotypes really hold or not?
A lot of times in many specialties, the stereotypes are there for a reason. You don't have to fit it, but I would be remiss if there were a lot of people in emergency medicine that didn't like the wacky nature of, like, you intubate and throw a central line in a person, and then you walk into the next room and they're like, my ankle hurts. And then you go around and there's a cardiac arrest, and, like, the wacky nature of it tends to attract certain people. A lot of us tend to be super outdoorsy as well, like hiking and the biking and the ADHD. Like, you don't have to fit that mold, but a lot of those stereotypes are there just because you kind of self-select specialty aside. When you're deciding a specialty, it's what are the people who I got the best vibe check from, and who do I see myself, like, grabbing a beer with, like, after a shift? You know what I mean? And then the nuts and bolts of the specialty tends to follow. So a lot of the stereotypes are true, but you don't have to.
No, that's good. I also wanted to ask you, it's like, you know, like, going from, like, a medical student all the, like, now that you're, like, a resident, like, did you find it daunting? Did you find it fun? Or were you anxious when you first started? Like, how was the switch?
I'm a little anxious at baseline, but I think that's more of a me problem. It's difficult in any transition point in education because by the end of undergrad, you're like, I'm a senior. I got my act together. Let's do it. And then the first week of med school hits you in the face and you're like, oh my God, this is crazy. And then you kind of gain confidence as you go. And then by the end of third, fourth year rotations, you're like, okay, I think I have an idea of what's going on. And then residency hits you in the face again. I think that's normal. I think being able to surround yourself with other people that kind of recognize how absurdly difficult these transition points are helpful, because we all feel that way. But then like by the end of anatomy or whatever in medical school, you're all kind of the same. And now in residency, like I have residents that went to like Columbia or some small school I've never heard of in the Midwest, and we all kind of level out in a couple months anyway. So it's stressful with the transitions, but I do think if you're not having some level of fun in your field by residency, I would really take stock in that. Like emergency medicine is difficult, but I love it, dude. Like it's so fun. Like you walk into a room and there's like some drunk guy like screaming at you and a pregnant lady with appendicitis and all these wacky things happening at the same time. But when I tell you, like I am zen up in there 90% of the time. It should be fun. I really hope everyone finds a field that they just have fun.
No, absolutely. And like one of the main things that like really draws me to emergency medicine is like the diversity that you have. Like it's like you like a master at all these different things, like, you know, stabilizing all these different patients from like different categories and stuff. It's like it must be fun to like see a variety of things. Each room is going to be different. Like, of course, you're going to have your bread and butter, but like you never know what you're going to have when you walk into a room, to be honest.
Yeah, one of the things I say about emergency medicine is I want to be someone's second choice for just about any problem, right? Like if you come in like chest pain, EKG changes, whatever, cardiology is the expert there, you know? But if you don't have a cardiologist, you want an ED doc because we look at a dozen EKGs every shift. You know what I mean? Like I like being the second best at a lot of things. Because knowing that the majority of patients are within a normal range for ED, but when we really are out of our depth, I like being able to reach out to a specialist. But I don't know, the diversity is definitely fun. I'm never bored on my shifts.
Now, one of the things I've told Said about this as well. One of the things I love about all the Stony Brook doctors we've interacted with is that, you know, any doctor that I've, you know, either shadowed or talked with, there's always some hint of the, oh, you know, you should come to, you know, when you're in med school, my specialty, you know, it's great. You know, they're trying to convert you to like be like, oh, you know, like this is a great field to some degree. But it's just a whole other level with Stony Brook doctors. And
yeah.
I shadowed a few people in GI my senior year. And I remember telling Saeed, these people we've had on the podcast, that, you know, they would just stop in the middle of the hallway after doing a procedure. And they'd be like, did you understand what I just did? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, doc, like a little bit. And they'd be like, no, you need to really understand it. And they just look around. Whatever they could find in the corridor, they'd turn it into a makeshift whiteboard and just being like, okay, yeah. so this is the part of the jejunum, and I'm like, what is happening over here? But yeah. it's so refreshing to see that, and in more Stony Brook doctors, and I guess that's not just a GI department thing. And you know, Stony Brook being, you know, level one, it's a trauma center in the area. You know, everyone on that portion of Long Island knows that it gets a lot of volume, especially the emergency department. And, you know, you've been there for a year, and I want to ask you, in your year, now that you're surrounded by emergency medicine, it's something you love, and you've explored that passion, I wonder, is there anything that you've learned about emergency medicine that perhaps you don't like as much, or that something about the culture that you would like to see changed, or that you would want to work hard and see that change in over the course of your career, perhaps?
Yeah, I can answer that in a couple different ways. Something I don't like, I'll kind of phrase in the sense of everyone has their own bias of a certain reaction, a certain patient type, a certain background. We have a lot of these unconscious biases, and it's good to be conscious of them. Something that I've really had to give myself pause for, like, why is this kind of patient type frustrating me, are patients who feel entitled to get what they want, regardless if it's medically indicated or not. And they act like they can threaten me as a doctor if I say, you don't need indomethacin, or not indomethacin, ivermectin for your COVID, because that's not a thing, sir. Or like, I promise your child doesn't need a CT of their head, because that's not what tells me they have a concussion and this is why. The things that frustrate me aren't those conversations. It's people who feel entitled to treatment regardless of their lack of expertise. And I've had to do a lot of thinking about that, you know, like, how do I develop patience for these people? Because at the end of the day, they're just scared too. You know what I mean? I pick up every psych patient, every substance use patient, every patient who's like angry, like violent. I pick them all up because for whatever reason, I have a tremendous amount of patience for those type of people. But I found like the hard part of residency has not been to do what's already easy for me, is to really challenge myself on my deficits. And I've really been trying to grow in that regard for things that I don't like as much. And instead of just saying like, it's because they suck, it's because of something that I need to work on. So that's the first part of the question. Something about emergency medicine that I hope changes is how quickly we can go from the most terrible of things, like a child who dies, or I have to tell a family that like their loved one is not likely going to recover from this, or bleeding in the brain, or like traumatic death. We deal, and even in the absence of death, like congestive heart failure, their mortality can be in like 50% in a year. Half of them can die next year. COPD is quite morbid. We can go into the most terrible of things and just be like, it do be like that, and then just like move on without processing any of it. And I feel like Stony Brook, we have a thing called Code Lavender, where we kind of like overhead page, like everyone stop, like recognize that a person was here and now they passed. And that's a big thing, right? I feel like right now we're at the stage of kind of forcing time on all of us to take a moment, because our volume is so high and there are so many patients to see. And I hope that gradually turns into something that happens naturally. It's just kind of built into our training to like have a moment, pause. We're all in therapy. I'm in therapy in residency. It's fantastic. Highly recommend it for everyone. But I just hope those things kind of built in, because emergency medicine is consistently one of the top three burnout specialties every year. And I think it's because we don't allow ourselves to feel the pain that we see every day until it's too late and we want to leave the field.
No, that's a tough point to like sort of bring up. Like, I see a lot of physicians like who essentially like bottle up their pain, or like they attempt to maintain like the strength. I've seen a lot of physicians like not get emotional in front of like emotional patients because they're not supposed to. So yeah, it's definitely like, I think the culture is definitely shifting, where it's like, you know, it's okay to feel vulnerable. It's okay to feel whatever you feel. It's part of being human, and physicians are still human at the end of the day. I just wanted to ask you about some of the policy and the structure that goes into like emergency medicine. Like, we see a lot of like triaging patients. When a patient comes in, you either just designate them to like a high emergent situation versus a low emergent situation. I was just wondering, like, the way that the landscape of medicine is essentially going towards, do you see a sort of like a shift in using sort of, or like having staffing, like either like nurse practitioners or PAs to like essentially help you manage the volume of patients that come in, like designate a higher emergent cases for physicians, or like, you know, just a regular checkup, or for like other providers as well?
Yeah, so there are a couple things that are happening that's becoming more common. Places like Stony Brook, like level one trauma centers, will have designated, this isn't just the ped side and the adult side, this is peds, this is lower acuity, this is geriatrics, and this is critical care. Like, that's what we have at Stony Brook. So when I'm on a shift in critical care, I am not going to see a single ankle sprain. I know that for a fact. I am not going to see that on that shift. I'm going to see heart failure, COPD, cardiac arrest, acute trauma, like big things. So segmenting different sections so that all the staff there is primed for what they're going to see is helpful. The second thing is there is a triage system, right? From level one being the highest acuity and level five being the lowest. Level five is like I rolled my ankle or I need my stitches taken out. Level four could be like, I might have broke my ankle. Level three is, do I have appendicitis? Level two is, I might be having a heart attack. And level one is, I'm having a stroke or I'm dead. Like, that's kind of what we use as well to kind of help with the flow of things. In the conversation around PAs and NPs, I don't like saying that the tough things are for the physicians and the easier things are for the NPs and PAs, because at Stony Brook, at least, that's not true. There are a lot of our PAs that have done way more intubations than me as an intern, way more like central lines and lumbar punctures. And there's a tremendous amount of depth that you can get from your advanced practice providers. But I think they're helpful in helping move the department along. Sometimes we just need bodies to just see people, do an exam, like give them meds, dispo them, order studies. And another reason why I don't like the physicians do the hard things and the mid-levels do the easy thing mentality is the last time I saw, I'm going to change this obviously for patient privacy, but like the last time I saw an aortic dissection, but like the aorta is the main thing that leaves the heart and they're split and now they're bleeding internally and they can die very quickly. The last time I saw that was in a low acuity patient who was a little older and their chief complaint was cough. And if there are medical school students listening to this, they know that aortic dissections only present with like rip-roaring chest pain, neurodeficits, I can't feel my feet, I'm dying right now kind of presentations. In real life, especially in Stony Brook, they could be like, got a little bit of a tickle in my throat, and they're actively dying. So I think the other thing about premature closure, what we call it, like, oh, this person's sick or not sick, is also a dangerous mentality. Because sometimes you might just have like an extremely old person with a high pain tolerance that just isn't complaining, but they're the one dying. And the 24-year-old rolling because they have a really small kidney stone that's not going to kill them. You don't need to just give the most attention to the person who's loudest. So in all those different ways, like emergency medicine is slowly evolving to be more efficient, but cognizant of what we usually miss that has the worst patient outcomes.
Right. And that's so interesting to hear, because, you know, that's not a perception of emergency medicine that we get as pre-meds. You know, for us, it's just like, okay, you know, emergency medicine is like zoom, 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 like fast, like, you know, sorting everything out as quick. But, you know, that's so interesting to hear the importance of sort of, you know, taking a proper look. But Josh, one of the things we wanted to ask you about when we had you on was that you have a beautiful daughter, Quinn. And you know, you've mentioned that, you know, the burnout is high in emergency medicine. Oh, Josh, you still there?
Oh no. Can you guys still hear me?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Yeah, sorry. No.
Oh, nice.
My headphones died and go. Sorry about that.
No worries, no worries at all. But yeah, you know, we talked about how burnout in emergency medicine is high. Heck, we even talked about how, you know, it's a storm just getting into medical school or through med school. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, you know, how do you balance your time between, you know, your devotion to your medical journey and, you know, raising Quinn? And, you know, what's interesting about your journey is that, you know, you've done that a little bit as a student, as well as a little bit as an emergency medicine resident now with, so we'd love to hear about, you know, what the challenges you find with that are, or if it's not challenging and you find it effortless, and, you know, what your lifestyle looks like with that.
I think it would be selfish and a lie for me to say that it was easy. Part of it is I have a tremendous partner in my wife who's been supportive of this entire journey. I have a family and parents that were incredibly supportive of me and my goals from the beginning. So I think part of it comes from just my mood throughout tackling something like medicine. It's really helpful when you come from a place of being supported by everyone you actually care about their opinion. So part of that is helpful. The second thing is in medical school and residency, my goals would be very simple. Like if I closed my rings on my Apple Watch and I did my Anki cards and I did some questions and I made dinner and I kissed my wife, or after Quinn was born, like if I was there and present when she was awake and I did most of my studying when she was asleep, like now in residency, like my kid's asleep. That's why I'm in the car. And thank you guys for scheduling around her sleep schedule. Like I tried to have the least of my life conflict with my family as possible. Knowing that when that can't be possible, I don't beat myself up about it. Like sometimes I'll tell my wife, like, hey, I know my shift was like 3 to 12, but like a cardiac arrest came in and I'm going to be leaving my shift 4 hours late. Like, don't wait up for me. My wife knows that I have my priorities in life are my family first and also my training, but sometimes training has to take precedence. So I think a lot of it, and a lot of people listening that don't have families, the general mentality of not beating yourself up, I think is a really underutilized skill. Like, you are going to do bad on a test. You're going to like gain 15 pounds your first year of medical school or whatever. And you're going to lose touch with some friends. And like, my main thing in college was like, I played the drums and I sang, and I don't get to do that very much anymore. But instead of holding on to that guilt and negative self-talk for an extended period of time, I'll be like, bummer. And then I immediately move on. Like, don't regret the time you've already lost. Just don't let it stay with you, so you keep losing that going forward. That's been really helpful for me, not just for my productivity, but also staying happy throughout this whole journey.
Awesome. And what I love about this episode so far is how much you're emphasizing the whole, you know, don't just push your all into, you know, the medical journey, because what you do outside of it, it's sort of like that mindset of, you know, it's what you do off the court that determines how good of an athlete you are. So, you know, like, I don't know, you could spin that saying, oh, I need to be training all day. But you know, that really means, you know, the more you rest, the more you, you know, have an emotional sink to, you know, dump all the emotion into and, you know, relieve stress, that all the other stuff is what determines how well you do your main craft. And, you know, you're a busy resident. You have Quinn, you have your family time. So I wanted to ask you, you know, when tensions are high, when you've had a busy week, when you're feeling burnt out yourself, if you ever do, what's your sort of emotional sink, or what's your way to reset?
So my thing is, I've been journaling in residency for the toughest of cases, for like the heaviest things. It's helpful to just get things out on paper, so it doesn't have to occupy rent-free in my brain for too long. That's helpful. Talking to my wife and my brother or someone else who I talk to a lot of things about, talking to them enough so I also get it out, but also not so much to burden them, can be challenging. Exercising has been helpful. I feel like oftentimes in medical training, since doctors themselves are bad patients, we can take a lot of bad habits, like drinking to excess a lot, or stress eating or other substance use. Self-harm can be a lot in medical training, as a quick band-aid to get over things. And like I said before, I put a lot of work into I have a journal system. I have my wife. I have another support system. I have a support system who are doctors. I have therapists. Like, I put a lot of work in knowing that it's not easy to have those things early on, but it will pay dividends 15 years from now that I have this habit rather than drinking a couple like beers after my shift every day. I think that's a good system that's worked for me. There are other people that don't need as much or compartmentalize it differently, or they'll do the emergency medicine thing and go on a bike ride or rock climb or whatever, and like that's enough therapy for them. So I definitely urge people to find out early what their triggers are for stress and to find any kind of resource to help get that out in front of others.
Absolutely. Those are very valuable advice, because like I remember like going through college and now like through my gap years, like I would have sensations of stress or guilt or whatever, and I would not be able to like recognize, oh, this is what's going on. Like now the fact that I'm able to recognize it, I can have a system, and then you can like move on after dealing with them. I think dealing with that and recognizing when you need help is a big part of like not burning out or essentially taking care of yourself for the future.
Yeah. And something I'll recommend to you guys, because you're still early in this journey, is to recognize that other people's stressors have nothing to do with you and what you find stressful. You can't quantify it against someone else, because that's a game that can be dangerous as well, right? Like, how does my stress compare to like the Vietnam vet that's here? Or like, whenever you play that comparison game, whether it's what'd you get on the orgo exam or how are you dealing with this patient who died? It's a game that no one wins, you know, because if you try to compare and to validate yourself or to validate someone else and lose what you think about yourself, like no one wins in that scenario. Instead, I urge you to find other people and just recognize some of the absurdity that you're going to see, especially now that you guys are working in your gap year here, and just use that to build each other up rather than to kind of have an us versus them kind of game. It's something that intuitively makes sense. Like, I see you guys, you're like, yeah, these are words that make sense to me. I urge you to like put it into a practice, something early, because there's a lot of work involved with that. And I really think that'll help you guys in the future.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for that. And like, I'm pretty sure that also pertains to our listeners as well, who is in this journey. It's a long journey. So strap in, try to take care of yourself. With that being said, Josh, thank you so much for spending your evening with us and sharing your journey through medicine. I'm sure that the advice that you've shared with us today will resonate with our listeners and hopefully impact them, help them in their own journey to medicine. Thank you for tuning in. Listeners, if you like what you hear, please feel free to subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Stay well, stay safe, and stay tuned for our next cup of chai.
I just wait. So I just wait. I know that you can fly, but you don't really feel good. No.
Hello, fellow chai enthusiast. If you're listening to this, this episode has now come to an end, and your cup of chai is empty as well. A little insider knowledge, just for you guys. Every step of making this episode involves a cup of chai. Sending emails to our guests, take a cup of chai. Writing a treatment for an episode, a cup of chai. And especially when we record our episode, we must have a cup of chai. So as you can see, we run through our chai mix, our chai patti, really quick. So if you can help us out by subscribing to us on Apple Podcast and Spotify, and follow us on Instagram under Chai Pies Podcast, we can keep running through our fair share of cup of chais for our episodes. If you DM us that we're the best pre-med podcast in Stony Brook, we'll give you a personalized shout out for making it this far. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you to Drestorm for giving us this amazing outro, which you can hear more from on Spotify under DREISTORM. Until then, see you for the next cup of chai.